Okay, good morning.
My volume is terribly low.
Okay, so this week we'll be talking about performance. So we started talking about performance in caches and how we could modify code to have better cache performance, particularly the technique of cache blocking. So we're going to finish that up a bit today and go on to some other ways that we can write code to increase performance, including talking about how compilers may or may not help with that. So first, some logistical notes. So we have some assignments about performance. So these are unlike our prior assignments. So there's a lab time scheduled for each of these, but there's no actual lab submission. And the assignments are either with partners or individually. If you have a partner for the assignment, the partner and you must be able to attend the same lab. This is so if you need help some point in the assignment, we don't need to have our lab TA play telephone. So we need you to be able possible to attend the same lab, so if you have trouble on the assignment, you can go to a lab together and get help from a TA and not have someone tell the TA, oh, that was what my partner did, and your partner say, that was what my partner did, and nothing happened. So there are two assignments listed on the page. There's one submission on Archimedes. We will grade each separately based on what you have submitted by each deadline. So there are two parts. So the first part is to rotate an image. And the image is represented as an array of pixels. The array is a 1D array, like the style we've used for our cache blocking examples, where it's really two-dimensional, but it's represented as a single pointer. And you do times the width plus the amount, so you get to the right row, then you get to the right column. And the second part is smoothing or blurring an image, which is just taking the average of the surrounding pixels for everything. And for each of the assignments, we give you a naive version, which is slow, but works and is correct. And your code that you produce that's faster needs to produce the exact same result. So the image representation in particular looks like this. So we have a struct called a pixel with a short which holds a red, green, and blue value. Maybe it's an unsigned short, but not that much space on the slide. And the image is dim times dim pixels. They're always square to keep things easy. Dim will be a parameter to your functions, and you use this sort of mechanism we had for the cache blocking to access rows and columns. So for rotate, this is basically what the code does, except the source part is cut off there, but it's IJK. We'll show you that in a second, what this RRITX thing is. But what you're doing is you're rotating an image. Okay. So RRITX is part of the assignment. It's a preprocessor macro. So I don't think we've talked about macros here. Okay. So macros are a C feature, also a C++ feature, that do a text substitution. So this RRITX looks like a function, but it isn't a function. So the way macros are defined are with pound define. So like pound include, this happens before anything gets compiled. So maybe you remember enough of C++, or told enough at least, that you remember that pound include with a .h file puts the .h file just as if you put it there. Pound define is something which acts at the same time. And it does a text substitution. So this double macro here, when I use it like this, it literally expands to that. This is before the compiler compiles the code. So it looks like a function call, but it actually gets replaced this way before the compiler compiles this into code. So as the first step of compilation before it actually generates any code. So this means that there's some weird things about macros if you're writing them yourself. So one notable thing, it's really a sex substitution. So this expands to that. It really just replaces X as the placeholder, which means that it's the wrong answer. So typically what you'll see done when people are writing macros like this is something like this, where you put extra parentheses, which are not really extra because you actually need them to get the right results in this case. Okay. So RIDX is a macro which just does the x times n plus y type of indexing you've seen earlier. So it's just the x times n plus y is just written out. You may find that more convenient, you may not. It's what the assignment uses to make the code easier to read. Yeah?
So is this assignment, are we coding in C?
So you're coding this in C. You will get a C file which has a correctly working implementation which uses this macro, and the usual strategy people have is to modify that implementation to add things we talked about or will talk about, like cache blocking. So I want you to make sure you can understand the working implementation. So you'll see in the assignment, we give you a C file with a bunch of implementations and way to add more. And we will test all the variants that you submit, and we will look at which ones perform best on sample test cases. And we will give you a file which runs all of them on a variety of image sizes. And these are the same sizes we will use to benchmark. But we will be measuring the speed up on my machine, not whatever machine you happen to be using. So in the assignment, I've given you the full specs for my machine if you care. But most likely, you'll just submit multiple variants that you think are all faster. And whichever one's fastest will be the one that determines what speed up you actually get. This means that some advice I have is, I've seen people do this in the past, if you have something that's faster and you want to like try out doing something based on it, like make a copy and modify it rather than getting rid of the thing that was faster. Just, you'll be disappointed, if you do something which ends up being slower but you thought would be faster and now you have to somehow get back to your faster version. So we're going to measure the speed up on my machine. I will have a viewer which will show you for your last submission, that after it's run, which will take like it probably at least 5 minutes, maybe more if things are busy, which will show you the results for all of your variants all the times, which is the same information you get running locally. But generally, the performance on your machine and my machine should be similar in the sense that if something's faster on your machine, it will usually be faster on mine, but this won't always be the case. Yeah?
So when you say that they're great, whichever one has the best performance, does that mean that it logs all the iterations that we've run, or that we need to have our fast one submitted from last?
So we will take your last submission, and you can have, so your last submission and your submission can have multiple variants in the C file you submit, and it will be the best performance of all those variants. It will not be your best performance over all time of all submissions. Yeah?
When you say best performance, is there a threshold that we must meet to get an A or something like that?
So grade is that you need to achieve a certain speed up. And in the assignment, we give a formula, basically. And what we've done is we've set two thresholds based on reference solutions I have that do just do certain optimizations we expect you to be able to figure out. And one of them is if you get up to one threshold, you get a 75. And if you get up to the other, you get 100. And otherwise, we just interpolate in between them. And those thresholds are based on, I have a submission where I did certain optimizations and I looked at what performance that got on my machine. So I know you should be able to achieve that. So I have the threshold set for rotate and they're in the assignment. There's ones for smooth in the assignment. I might adjust the 100% one a little bit down based on performance, but not by much. But basically they're based on optimizations I think that are reasonable for you to figure out. That shouldn't require a whole bunch of experimenting to find.
And when you say variations, do you mean we copy the same code and have multiple main or run multiple things on a main method, or what do you mean multiple variants?
So multiple variants. So the template code we give you will have a way of registering multiple copies of the function. So you'll be able to say, here's a function that implements smooth or rotate, and here's what it's called. And you can do that multiple times, and it will run all of them. And when you're running locally, it will give you something where you run all of them and it will just tell you what has happened on your machine for each of them, so you can compare them. Yeah?
Are the thresholds listed on the lab assignment?
Yes, but the thresholds are on my machine, right. So. And the viewer for your results will show you the computed grade. Yeah.
How would you work that the compiler?
So we will tell you exactly how we are running the compiler. And it is the exact same compiler that is on the lab Unix 1, 2, and 3. So if that matters, you have the exact same compiler with the exact same options you can check. But as I said, usually, if something's faster on your machine, it will usually also be faster on mine. Maybe not by the same amount, but usually that holds. Compiler version differences are a bit different. And the big case where this would happen to people is if you're comparing on OS X with Clang, which is a compiler with a completely different code base than GCC, something very different might happen. And note that GCC on recent OS X is actually Clang sometimes. But that's the only case I would think of where it's likely you'd see big differences in direction of optimization as different compiler versions. So you can control for that. But most of the time, like if it makes it faster in case A, it's going to make it faster in case B, even though the hardware's different, just not by the same amounts. Okay, so general advice for this. So this is often a kind of frustrating assignment because some things work, some things don't. So you should try things from the book or lecture that seem applicable. For each assignment, there's basically one thing which is really important and will be like 95% of your speed up. Or at least 95% of the speed up you need to get an A on the assignment. And you are responsible for figuring out what that is, either by trial and error or by thinking about what does this do, could X matter? You should vary numbers. So if you're trying cache blocking and it doesn't work, that doesn't mean necessarily that cache blocking isn't applicable. If your numbers are way too big or way too small, you might get no effect or a negative effect. Like cache blocking with a way too big cache block size or a way too small cache block size might be worse just because you have all this overhead and you aren't getting any real cache benefits. Generally, there will be a large range of values where you get some good performance difference and like a peak, but there are spaces where if you're just way off on the numbers but you're doing the right optimization, you might not get an improvement. So for cache blocking, like if your cache block size is huge, you aren't doing anything, right? You're just making the loop more complicated, which is going to be slower. And if it's really small, you might not be caching enough, reusing enough in cache to see a difference. And especially since you have extra loop overhead. And I would also note that some techniques combine well. So in some cases, you'll see like cache blocking might give you more benefit after you do some other optimizations. So any questions about the assignment sort of setup? Yeah.
You said something about having a partner, you must be able to go to the same lab. Is that the same thing as being in the same lab?
So if you have a partner for the, so you can do the assignment in partners or individually. If you do it in partners, we suggest you do it for both parts. Yes, if you have a partner, you must be able to attend the same lab. This need not be the lab you are registered for. We just want it to be the case that if you come to my office hours on Friday and you say, I have no idea what we're doing, that I don't have to say, how do I schedule both of you to be in the same room at the same time? Yeah.
Maximum two people, you can't have groups of three?
It is partners, maximum two people, under no circumstances three people. One person is okay, two people are okay, three people is never okay. Okay, any other questions about the assignments? Okay, so last time we were talking about doing cache performance and doing cache blocking. where our idea was that we'd fix something like this matrix squaring loop where we're accessing everything here n squared times, and everything but one of these three array accesses would be pretty much guaranteed to miss in the cache every single time. So in this case, the access here, ai times n plus k, would probably hit almost every time, because it's accessed over and over again. It has very good temporal locality, and everything else was horrible. And maybe there was some spatial locality, but other than that, we were missing in the cache every single time. And our fix for this was to do our work in little blocks. So we'd work on a block of some size, and the idea would be that we'd access stuff over and over again in that block, but each time we loaded an element of Bij, we'd use it again some number of times in the future. So in this case, we'd use it again k times after we accessed it once, in shortly afterwards. So hopefully it would still be in the cache. So we reduced the number of misses, we divided it by big K in this case, where K is how big our block was for the K variable, little k. And something similar for all the other things we were accessing in the innermost loop. And a way of thinking about this is that we have our A matrix and our B matrix, and we chose a little block of it to work on at a time. And we would work on this block in such a way where all these green sections would stay in the cache. And we wouldn't have to worry about not having them used once and then never used again. We'd at least all the computations that for this green section that involve these other parts of A and B would be using the cache. They'd reuse those values of A. So any questions about sort of cache blocking or review of that? And so our compromise here was that we slightly reduced our locality, but probably not our performance, because as long as all these green parts fits in the cache, we should have just as many cache hits with what we had really good temporal locality, and that was AIK. Right? As long as we didn't have too much access between accesses to those AIKs, those should all still be hits, and we have all these other cache hits because we're using values for calculations over and over again, at least more times than we were before. So this basically gave us better spatial and temporal locality, and in the best case, we would adapt those little blocks to be about the size of the cache, so we'd basically be using all of the cache and getting the maximum number of hits we can get given what our calculation looks like. Inevitably, we still have a lot of misses, but they'd be a lot less. Yeah.
So when you say we match it to the size of the cache, that is you're matching the total number of elements across all three blocks to be the total size of your cache.
Yeah. So intuitively, what you think is we're making all these fit in the cache. In reality, it might be a little more complicated because of writes. So we're mostly writing to B, so it might not actually be so important for B to fit in the cache, because we might just write through, and that can actually be faster than you guess. But approximately, yeah, that they all fit in the cache. There's also some other things which make this slightly not the same, in that there are cache blocks that contain these, and that means we have to load a little more than these blocks to have these in the cache. So it's not going to be precisely that these exactly fit in the cache, but it's approximately that. Yeah?
When we're doing the assignment, so we're supposed to make our blocks fit in your cache because we're going to be testing it on your machine. Does your machine have a similar size cache or close to the...
So the question is, for the assignment, if you want to make the blocks approximately fit in my machine's cache, how do we know about that? So in the assignment write-up, I do tell you about all the caches on my machine, if you want to look that up. And in general, I note that cache blocking will give you most of the benefit if you get pretty much, if you don't quite match the size. Because most of the benefit here is that you're dividing by this big factor. So if you're kind of close and it still fits in the cache, you're still going to get like 80% of the benefits. So most of the work is not going to be actually getting the exact right size. Like that's the like last 10 or 20% of the performance. Most of your performance is getting kind of close. Where kind of close probably means like you can be off by like, you know, a factor of 2 or 3 and still get a lot of benefit. So like we saw for cache misses that even blocking by a factor of 2 helped the number of misses a whole lot, which made sense because they were in the same cache block. So even a little bit of cache blocking will help. It's just that your maximum benefit, that last like 10 or 20% is when you match the size of the cache. So if we're doing the assignment, your first priority should be to make sure you get that like 80% benefit. And it might not even be worth tuning to get the last part versus other optimizations you could try, which might give you more benefit for the amount of work you do, like trying all the various block sizes that are kind of close. Especially because you have to deal with the leftovers for cache blocking, which is very annoying. Yeah?
Is there a limit for the number of bands
There is a, so the question is there a limit to the number of variants we can submit? There is a time limit for which how long I will test your submission on my machine.
How long is
I might tune it, but it's on the order of a minute. But if this becomes a problem, I might tune it a little lower. But so I note that so I have slides on this here. Okay. So a difficulty, a reason you might not want to tune it so much is that when you're doing cache blocking, a difficulty is that like this picture suggests kind of that these blocks go right up to the edge. Often that doesn't happen. Often you have like some awkward sort of half block in the corner, and that's actually really hard to make fast, because that's like a special case for your loop. And if you optimize your loop, as we'll talk about today, to like handle exactly the block size well, it won't be a good loop for not the block size. So most likely, most of you are going to take advantage of an assumption on the assignment that you might miss on the first read through, which is that when we have these matrices here that represent these images, we will guarantee that they are multiples of 32 in size. And you only need to work for sizes which are multiples of 32.
Well, could you repeat that one more time?
So the assignment, it mentions this. All the sizes we will test will be multiples of 32, and we will only care that you work for multiples of 32. So you are encouraged to take advantage of this to make things simpler. So for real, when you're doing real optimization, obviously you'd make it work in general. But usually the way that works is you like get some special case working, and then you handle how you deal with if the size isn't exactly right, how you deal with the leftover stuff. But that is not an annoyance we want you to deal with. But for that reason, you might not want to try every single cache block size, because some of them will be pretty awkward and probably slower for that reason. Okay, so when I talked about cache blocking, I had our example, and I said that, you know, it actually improved performance. And one note about how it improved performance is that on my original version, it didn't. It was slower. And when I actually optimized the loop for how the multiplies and loads were done, it was ended up being a bit faster in this case. This is for small sizes. For large sizes, there's a much bigger benefit because we ran out of space in my L3 cache. So what was happening here? Why did I have this gap here? So we've talked about sort of the basic concept that underlies this, though it's not obvious. This is because I have an out-of-order processor. So what about out-of-order processors can make this sort of thing happen? So when are the out-of-order processors going to do the loads from cache? What? When you're...
When they're, like, using the... Wait, what do you mean? Like, are you, when you're asking when they're going to, like, check the cache?
Yeah.
When they're using the data?
So when we need the data. Okay. So... Are they going to wait until, so the question is, I guess, is more when are they going to run the load instruction? And in the out-of-order processor, one of the benefits we talked about is that if you have a long load instruction, you can run other things at the same time. And most likely what's happening here is that my timeline looks something like this. That because my loop was inefficient, yeah, my loads are taking a long time, but the processor couldn't, because I was doing the multiplications and additions and the loop stuff inefficiently, that was taking more time. And this is sort of a thing you might expect to see in some sorts of optimizations that, you know, it's not that the cache performance didn't matter, it just didn't matter yet. Once I fix this, I fix these multiplies to not take up this much room, it probably was wider in my real case, I had the case where now these loads were the problem. But before I optimized the loop, I was actually waiting on these multiplies. And this is something you might see when you're doing optimization yourself, that you know some other optimization will help after you get rid of a different bottleneck. You know, that maybe the cache performance doesn't matter yet because something else happened, or vice versa. Or maybe, you know, the loop overhead doesn't matter yet because you're spending all your time waiting on loads. But when you make the cache better, then you have to start optimizing the loop to get more performance or something like that. So this is not guaranteed to happen. And as I said, for our assignments, there's one optimization which is absolutely most important, not two. But this is something that you might happen, is that just because it didn't help before you improve something doesn't mean it won't help later. And this is because our processors do things in parallel. And it's the slowest thing that can matter in many cases. Okay. So that's my review of cache blocking. So any general questions about cache blocking? So before we move on to the sorts of loop optimizations I did to actually see that increase in performance. Okay. So let's start by talking about compilers. Because our first way to optimize things is going to be to tell our compiler to do it. This is way less effort than anything else you'll do to optimize things, and often provides a pretty big benefit. And the reason you want to do this is that if you don't tell your compiler to optimize, it will generate horrible code. So here's a simple loop. Here's part of the assembly output with annotations. That's not the label names the compiler used. And you see the compiler is doing really silly things, like everything's accessed from memory, like this minus 24 RBP is getting the pointer A from the stack instead of putting it in a register. We're keeping the sum on the stack instead of putting it in a register. This is very wasteful code. Yeah?
Why are we using RBP if it's on the stack?
So the question is, why are we using RBP instead of RSP? The compiler has decided to use a frame pointer instead of a stack pointer. This is another thing about not having optimizations. Yeah.
Why would the compiler, like, what in it that like deterministically makes it have this like not very optimized code?
So the question is, why does the compiler default to generating this very bad code? So the simplest thing to do as a compiler writer is to have all variables be on the stack, then you never have to worry about running out of registers, and to do all and to load things from the stack only when you need them. Right? That's the easiest way to write a compiler, and this is the baseline that many compilers have. So if you don't tell GCC to do any optimizations, that's the code it starts with. Its optimizations are all fixing this baseline to be better. So moving things from the stack to registers, you know, and other sort of improvements based on that. But the baseline is going to be this horribly inefficient thing. So, you know, basically you never want to compile without any optimizations. And for example, modern GCC didn't used to have this, has a flag optimized for debugging, which is -og, big O, little g, which is designed to get enough optimizations that maybe the assembly is okay, but it still is good for the debugger. But you want some optimizations because, we have this very bad code here that's going to be very inefficient. So in particular, if you're worried about accessing the cache a lot, boy, are we doing that. So even if it's a cache hit, loads still take time compared to register reads, especially in an out-of-order processor where we don't have a memory stage in the pipeline in the same way as our pipeline processor. This is pretty slow compared to what it could be. Yeah.
Well, would you ever want to use like the -o3 or O4 flags to, if it could possibly change the output of your program?
I will talk about that in a second. So this is unoptimized code. So if we ask GCC to generate some optimized code, we get something that's often much better. So here I patch -os. The O, big O, little s means optimized for size, which that's why there's nice compact code here. So this is compact and also faster. This is optimized for size, not necessarily speed, though it's usually faster than the unoptimized version, certainly. So you can see that this generates the sort of code you might write by hand. Not much more what you're used to. We've actually kept things in registers. We are using just the complex addressing mode of x86 with three operands to access the array, the most natural thing to do. We're using an ink instruction. We have a test at the beginning of the loop. So this is optimized for size. This is pretty efficient. And this is the sort of thing the compiler will do with optimizations, that it figured out to that, I can keep these values in registers. I can do the address calculation in one instruction, in the same instruction I'm doing the add, and so on. One can also do tricks like, remember, use RAX because it needs to return that anyways, rather than having an extra move. So GCC has a whole bunch of optimization flags, as does every other compiler. And if you pass, say, different optimization flags, like -o2, you'll get different output. And so here's the output with labels changed to be a little more readable of what GCC does with -o2. So here, it's a bit trickier. It got rid of the add instruction using the three operand form, and instead, it advances a pointer. Rather than incrementing an index, it actually keeps a pointer to the current element of A and increments it by 8, the size of a long. This is something the compiler has the logic to figure out how to do for a loop, and will often do, and it's faster because we don't have to shift over by 3 every time, so we don't have to do that address calculation, which is going to be faster on our out-of-order processor. And this is longer code, but it's probably faster. Also, we have the comparison at the bottom of the loop, so we don't have a jump followed by a conditional jump like we did in the other version. This is generally faster code. So this is what GCC generates with -o2, which is the sort of normal, I want to optimize this code optimization level for GCC. So GCC has other optimization levels. So someone mentioned like o3, o4. So generally, most o3 does optimizations that take longer to do and sometimes are slower in GCC. That's what the o3 flag is for. And o1, we're -o, does optimizations that are like pretty straightforward and like probably don't increase your compilation time by very much. So are still fast to compile. Yeah. So the question is, are these strategies similar to things we'll talk about? So for the most part, we're going to focus on things that the compiler can't do. But we will talk a bit about things the compiler does, because some of them you'll want to do by hand in a more aggressive way. Or sometimes you'll need to do it because the compiler won't be able to figure it out in some cases. Okay. So I showed you some examples of what optimizing compilers do, and you can obviously run GCC a bunch to figure out what it does. They usually make your code faster, at least faster. And you have to turn them on. So if you just always compile with GCC, no flags, you aren't compiling with optimizations, don't be surprised if your code is really slow, because it's probably reading and writing from the stack all the time. And compilers and humans are going to be good at different types of optimizations. So we're going to talk about compiler limitations, things that compilers have trouble doing. It's not that it's impossible for them to do it, it's that they usually can't figure out some kinds of optimizations for various reasons. And there's several sorts of limitations that compilers usually have. So one limitation is that the compiler needs to make the code do exactly the same thing. It can't look at the code and say, well, that's never going to happen, and no one's ever going to do that. That's not something that we care about. It needs to make the search still produce the same result, even in weird corner cases that you obviously don't intend to be used. And this is a big case where it will seem like a compiler could optimize something, but it won't. Yeah?
What's an example of a corner case that doesn't?
We'll get to one right after this. So another limitation of compilers is that usually optimizers will work approximately a method at a time. Not always, but usually. So most optimizations won't look across a function call to see what's happening. This doesn't always happen, and even if compilers do look across function calls, it is even less common for them to look between files. So you have code in one file and code in another. The compiler probably can't look between those two files at all. This is not always true, but often you need to do extra work for that to happen. And if compilers all the time looked between functions, this would make them a lot slower. That's the big reason they don't do it. Yeah.
So don't the -03 and -04 flags, they don't guarantee that your code will do the same thing though?
So you're saying, don't the -03 and -04 flags not guarantee your code does the same thing? So this is not true in GCC. Okay. Modulo bugs in the compiler. With some caveats. So remember we talked about undefined behavior. So at the higher optimization levels, compilers might be more aggressive about assuming you don't use undefined behavior. And this often causes surprises for people. In particular, there might be rules in the C standard that you can usually get away with ignoring that the compiler will start enforcing by making optimizations that assume like you're not overflowing integers or other things like you're not accessing a pointer through the wrong type. So that's the sort of thing where you get in trouble. GCC does have optimization flags which will change what your code does, but they are not 03 or 04. So there's one called OFAST, which changes slightly what some floating point operations do, which can change what code does. But most of the normal ones don't actually do this, except that if your code uses undefined behavior in ways which usually don't matter, it might start mattering. Okay. So we talked about not looking into a method. So another thing is that the compiler doesn't know what your input values typically are. They can't look at a loop and say, this loop is important and will be run lots of times, or this loop usually has a very small iteration count. So it needs to make its choices about what to do with something like a loop based on a guess. And you, as a programmer, have more information about, is this a loop that's like does 1 to 3 iterations, or is this a loop which is going to do thousands of iterations? Compiler also, when it's making optimizations, often wants to do things that are going to make your code longer. So we saw that here. This is longer. It's faster because we're like, we have this set up, but now we're adding to a pointer instead of incrementing two things, basically. But it's longer. And some of the optimizations we'll talk about can make code much longer. And the compiler doesn't understand what your trade-off is for that. How much bigger are you willing to make your program to make it faster? especially since it doesn't know like how many loop iterations you have. Is this loop important or not? Would you care if I made this take up 2 kilobytes? Or would you be very frustrated that why are you making a part of my program that takes up 0.1% of my runtime take up half my file? So the compiler doesn't know to do that. So any questions about any of these limitations beyond the question for an example of corner cases? Okay. So that will go on to our example of a corner case. And probably the most insidious one is aliasing. This is when two things refer to the same, two things are names for the same thing. And our book gives this example, that we have this method, and you might be tempted to generate this code for it, where we basically load the value from py, multiply it times 2, by adding it to itself, fastest way to multiply times 2, or shift right, shift left, either of those, and then add it back to I flipped these variables, but yeah, add it back. So if you attempted to implement this by just multiplying times 2, rather than accessing py twice. And I apologize for flipping the variables in these comments and there. But so you might be tempted to do this with less memory accesses. But this is wrong. The compiler can't do this optimization. It can't turn this into load each value once, store once. It can't do that because you can call this in a weird way. In particular, you can call it where both pointers are the same thing. In which case it gives a different answer. So this is an example of a corner case. So this is a very contrived case, but it illustrates sort of the concept that the compiler, when it looks at two pointers, it needs to say, oh, these might point to the same thing. It needs to worry about that all the time. It can never assume that, unless it can somehow prove they're different pointers, which it can't do in this case without looking outside this function, that they'll produce the same result, that it can do this optimization. So if it wanted to generate faster code, something like this, it would need to first test, are the pointers equal? Which it could do, but that's also going to be slower, and it doesn't really know when that makes sense to do or not. So generally, the compiler is not going to generate the fast code for this. So as I said, this seems like a contrived example, but aliasing as a thing that restricts compilers from optimizing comes up all the time. And it particularly comes up when we're dealing with arrays. So, for example, here are two methods, and the first one has an aliasing problem. So, when the compiler is compiling some rows one, it needs to assume that result in matrix might point to part of the same array. And if that happens, then this plus equals operation needs to row the thing from result each time. Because it might be the same thing we're accessing in matrix in a future, in the next iteration or something like that. So as a human, you know that no one's going to call it like this. No one's going to pass part of the matrix as a result for this function. But the compiler doesn't know that and has promised to, you know, execute this code correctly for you. So it's not going to do that. So that means if you explicitly do something like this, where you have a local variable, that the compiler can generate much better code. So in this case, since this is a local variable, the compiler knows there's no pointers to it. There's no way that matrix or result could point to this variable. It's just not possible. Because it's a newly defined local variable, no one's ever taken a pointer to it, so clearly they don't alias. So this is how we help the compiler out. But without that help, in something like this, the compiler needs to say, oh, result and matrix, they might point to the same thing. So yeah, this makes a big difference in performance. So you want to see number differences. So if we just do the obvious thing, if we compare the two things, and we look at cycles per count, we see a little difference in performance. This is with Dash-02. So you can see that telling the compiler, you can actually keep this in a register, you don't need to load it every time, helped our performance a bit. And on my machine with Dash-03, it helps even more because it actually enables more optimization as the compiler can do, which is a common thing. Like when the compiler learns that, oh, I can keep things in registers and that these values aren't reused, that enables other tricks. Yeah.
So to clarify, so because the things is pointed in the same place every time you're adding to it, they're reloading the...
Yeah, so with the first version, which is the blue lines here, it thinks every time I need to reload it. The other version, it can say, oh, I can keep the sum for the row in a register. Because I don't need to worry about updating the matrix, just in case. So here, it can keep the sum for a row in a register, but it needs to make sure it updates the result array every time. Because it worries that maybe the result array is the same as matrix. And that will affect a future thing we add to result.
So wouldn't that affect reloading matrix, not result?
So you need to store the matrix through result if they alias. So the concern is that if matrix and result alias, matrix needs to not only be reloaded, but result needs to be stored to update matrix. Because if they refer to the same thing, storing to result is how you update matrix. Yeah, so the compiler can't eliminate the load or the store. At least not simply. So this is why we have this performance difference, because the compiler couldn't figure out that, oh, I can keep the sum in a register, because it can't in general. And this is the difference between having the sum in a register and not. So ordinarily, if the compiler knew there was no aliasing, it could just keep it in a register and would be pretty good at that. But since it couldn't know that, we have this performance difference from doing those extra stores. Maybe also from doing extra loads, but probably not. And generally, getting rid of these limitations about, you know, having the compiler worry about doing all these loads and stores in a strict order gives it more freedom to do other optimizations, which is why there's this big performance difference. Yeah.
To what scope is that like affected?
What?
So it's like, because I assume even if you have like two things or two pointers the same thing, and like you may not actually have to write it, but it would write it because just to be safe, like. To what scope does that include? Like by the end of a method?
So the question is, when does the compiler have to write to result row?
Yeah, or like just in general, if you have like two pointers and the compiler is concerned that the first one is the same as the second one, but you don't actually need the first one out of scope, and it's just like kind of like a temporary variable, like. How long later would it just write?
So the question is, if the compiler knows two pointers might point to the same thing, when does it have to do, if you write to one and read from the other, when does it have to do that write?
Yeah.
And the rule is it has to do the write before the next read in the code.
For any pointer.
For any pointers that might point to the same thing. So in this case, it's pretty bad, because it has to do the write to result before the next read from matrix. Which means it basically can't get rid of any of the stores to results.
Even if it was out of the method?
The problem is we're reading matrix in the method.
Yeah.
So, like, if it could prove that matrix was never read, then it doesn't have to worry, right? But it clearly is. Yeah.
You declare two objects in your main method and then make two pointers to them. Mm-hmm. Is that one of the cases where I can verify that they're different?
So the question is, if we call this with two pointers to different things, can it figure it out? And the answer is maybe. But you have to look at our usual compiler limitations. So it often won't look inside a method. It also won't look outside a method, often. So it could figure it out, but often it won't do the work to do that. It won't do that much analysis. And this is mostly a performance trade-off. The compiler could try to look at main and how it calls everything and keep going down to try to do all this proving, but that's going to take a lot of extra compilation time. And usually you won't actually be able to prove anything. So this is a trade-off. So maybe at a higher optimization level, the compiler might do more work to that. So sometimes it will probably be able to figure it out, but often it won't go through the compilation time to do it.
I didn't mean inside of a function. Like, if you declare it in main, and then way later in main, you use those two pointers, would it check like the top of main? Or is that
so the question is, in the same function, if I declare two pointers and assign them to different objects,
even if it's like really long,
would it figure it out? And the answer is sometimes. So if it's really long, it might have to figure it out, it needs to understand everything about how that really long stuff can affect those pointers. So if there's something tricky in there, it might not understand what's going on, in which case it has to assume the worst. Yes?
So you keep mentioning that the compiler has to prove that the two pointers don't alias.
Yeah.
So for example, let's say I have an if statement, like if the two pointers are not equal, then perform this method. Would the compiler be able to optimize this?
So the question is, if I just test myself for aliasing, can the compiler then use that information? So maybe. I would be skeptical, because the test to see if the pointers are to the same thing here is not actually as straightforward as you think. Because you need to test, does result point to anything that overlaps with matrix? So for the simple case, yeah, the compiler that would be might be easier to figure out, but I wouldn't count on it because the compiler needs to implement particular logic that like looks at the comparison, which is not guaranteed. It's not usually how the compiler knows two things to an alias, but maybe it could figure it out from that. For this case, you could have the same test, but it seems pretty unlikely the compiler would figure out what that test is doing. Maybe it would. Because the test here is, do they overlap? It's like arithmetic. It's you have to like, is result minus like n less than array, less than matrix sort of thing. But maybe that would help. But usually your best solution is to do something like this. Have a local variable where it's easy for the compiler to know there's no aliasing problem here. It's a local variable, it's not a pointer. Okay. And aliasing is one reason why we need to do cache blocking by hand often. So in code like this, if the compiler is worried about aliasing, it can't do the cache blocking for us. So even if it knew to do cache blocking, which some compilers do, It needs to deal with the aliasing in some way. Either it needs to test explicitly, do these things overlap, which is not a thing compilers often do, or it needs to somehow know they don't alias. Because if they do, in this case, you know, if B is a pointer to A offset of 10, then all of a sudden you can't do this transformation. It is not safe. As a human, you know that the transformation doesn't do anything because who's going to make B and A point to the same thing? But the compiler needs to deal with this case. This is one reason why we don't see the compiler often do cache optimizations for us, even if it could implement the logic. Yeah?
Is there any flag where you just turn off checking for?
So the question is, there any flag where you just turn off checking for aliasing? The short answer is no, because it would break lots of code. It would break lots of code in the standard library. So, bad idea. There is things you can do to help with that, which I'll get to in a bit. Okay, so the sort of thing we've been doing by helping by getting rid of aliasing is sort of a general pattern of optimization, which is worrying about redundant loads. So, and also redundant stores. I guess I should say redundant loads and stores. But loads are the worst case for this. So if we, we want to avoid redundant loads, and we were doing that in our sort of interesting aliasing case here, where by getting rid of loading result of row each time and storing result of row each time, we got rid of this extra work where we access the cache over and over again. And the compiler does this by itself, but it can't do it when there's something like aliasing going on. And this is also a problem here. So there's a redundant load here, also some redundant store. Yeah, there's a redundant load here. Can someone tell me what it is? Where's something where, because of aliasing, the compiler's going to load something over and over again, where it could just have it be loaded once. It could just put it in a register. Yeah? So is it B of I times N plus J? So we do load that multiple times, but only on different iterations of the outermost loop. So that isn't actually something we can put in a register and keep reusing. Yeah? Yeah, so, but it's AI times N plus K. So ideally, the compiler would just load this once and use it for every iteration of this J loop. But it can't do that if it fears aliasing, because B might point to the same thing at some point, and it needs to check each time. So it needs to reload it. So we can help the compiler out. Just like we had that sum variable, which avoided the compiler worrying about result sum being the same thing, we can make a local variable for it. And this is going to tell the compiler that, oh, okay, that AIK, I'm just going to load it once and I'm going to keep it in a register, because this code, that's the easiest way to implement this code. And we've just told it basically that it doesn't overlap in a meaningful way with B, because we just load it once and never care about how the rest of B do. Yeah?
So I'm seeing a recurrent pattern here that to avoid the aliasing, you use local variables and local variables sort of, for lack of a better word, our savior in this case.
So the question is, is it local variables that are a solution? Yeah, generally, our usual solution to aliasing is use local variables, because the compiler knows how local variables work.
So at what point, I would imagine that the designating this for the local variable is going to take time. So is there a point at which, you load too many local variables to the point where, if you're doing a really, really long, complex operation?
We'll get to that maybe next time. But yeah, if you run out of registers, you're in trouble. That's the short answer. So you want the number of local variables, you want things to actually fit in registers. The compiler is copying a value from A to the stack that's not so great for you. So another thing to note is that when we do cache blocking, we actually expose more repeated loads. So in this case, we're accessing bi times n plus j's repeatedly and ai times n plus k's repeatedly. And we could actually sort of expand out this code so we can get rid of the redundant loads and stores of bij, the same way we got rid of the sum out of the loop. So we just move the load of bij and the store of bij out of this innermost sort of cache blocking loop. And this is going to help our performance a bit, because the compiler couldn't know that that's safe to do otherwise, because B might overlap with A. And we can do the same thing with the two AIKs. So this is the same concept, we're just applying it repeatedly, and in the process we're also sort of manually expanding our loop a little bit because it's short. So this is a common sort of thing that's complementary to cache blocking. It does some similar stuff to cache blocking, but instead of accessing the cache repeatedly, now we're accessing registers. So we're putting AIK0 in a register and accessing it repeatedly from a register, which is faster than hitting it in the cache. And you know, it's a sort of generalization of this technique, which is ugly, but is something sometimes called register blocking. It's the same idea as cache blocking. We work on a little block in registers. And here I have 8 variables, and my idea is that hopefully when the compiler compiles this, it uses 8 registers to store values. And I know that's a reasonable number because we actually have 8 registers. If we didn't have 8 registers, it would not be a good value because they just have to go in the stack or something. So any questions about what's going on here? Yeah.
Wait, so this has to do more with the homework. But like, so you said the input will be multiple 32. What's like the average order of that?
Like, we will give you, the question is what's the sizes for the homework? For the homework, we will give you a test program which tests on certain sizes. Those are the exact sizes we will be grading you on. Your score will be based on the mean speed up over a range of sizes.
There's
a list of sizes, of 6 sizes, and your score will be the average speed up, actually the geometric mean of the speed ups on all those sizes. Okay. Other questions about this or something related? So this is, so sort of a generalization of just the concept of if you have something you're accessing repeatedly, put it in a local variable so the compiler knows, I can put this in a register. Because otherwise, with aliasing, the compiler often can't figure that out itself. Just because it actually would be generating wrong code if it put it in a register without checking memory in some way. So you often have to help the compiler out for that reason. So someone asked, is there something else we can do? So C has a keyword which is supposed to solve this problem called restrict. And restrict is a keyword which says, I promise this pointer doesn't alias another pointer. And if it does, and you use the restrict keyword, that's undefined behavior. And the syntax is a bit strange. The keyword goes after the star. That's just how it works. My success with adding the restrict keyword doing anything has been very low. So it exists. I don't know that compilers actually do much with it. And I note that, this does invoke undefined behavior. So if they do something and you use it wrong, the compiler can generate some really weird wrong thing. Because it can decide that 2 pointers that you thought were, unrelated, it can do some weird optimization on. Okay. And an aside, since we're talking about this sort of blocking code, is about addressing efficiency. So one thing this code does when it loads things from the matrix is it seems like we multiply by n every iteration. And that's not actually the most efficient thing to do. What we'd like to do is we like to just add n to something every time. And the compiler will in fact do this. So this is a transformation where I just increment a pointer by n, which is the same as adding n, or I could keep track of an index and add n. So this is something which is faster. And usually, the compiler will do this. This is an optimization where the compiler can look at a loop and actually figure this out most of the time. I'm not going to talk about how compilers work and why that happens, but usually the compiler will do it. I'm mentioning it because the compiler usually does it. So it usually takes code which does I times n and then plus plus I in a loop and turn it into something like this. But sometimes it doesn't. And when it doesn't, it's really surprising because you'll change the loop a little bit and suddenly it's a lot slower. This is something which can happen. If it doesn't, you can do it yourself. So usually you won't have to do it, but this is, you know, a thing which sometimes will speed it up if the compiler didn't figure it out. A reason why the compiler wouldn't figure it out is if you made your loop a lot more complicated. Like you added cache blocking and in a funny way, and the compiler couldn't see what was happening. Okay, yeah. So the question is, how much do these strategies apply when you're not just adding things to different parts of an array? So the sort of register blocking thing is just like dealing with matrices, but the general concept of removing redundant loads happens all the time. Like often you'll get a pointer to something and another pointer to something, and the compiler still needs to worry that they point to the same thing. Like even if there's no arrays anywhere. And remember that we're dealing with pointers, but in like C++, this would be like references count. That would be another case where the compiler couldn't optimize it. So it does still come up a lot of the time. Not in the same extent as with dealing with big arrays, but it's still an issue. I'm talking mainly about arrays because this is a case where we have loops that work on lots of data, which is often the case where we care most about performance. Yeah?
So if it's a problem with things like references, I'm curious how this works for other higher level compiled languages that just do everything as references. Do they simply end up compiling slower because they can't?
So the question is, how does this work for other languages which only deal with references? So I note that you can still sometimes show that things don't alias. And this is easier in a higher level language where you can't, where if you have two arrays, you're accessing them through different references. Mm-hmm. And like you can't have one reference where index I is the same as index j in another. Like that helps a lot. So that can help the compiler like at least prove that things don't alias enough to be a problem in those cases. So it is easier. And you don't have to worry about like offset aliasing like the compiler does here for that. So it does make it easier. Also in higher level languages, you generally, if the references have different types, you can make strong assumptions about them not being the same thing. This might be harder in C, where typically you'll have like a pointer to an int, which the compiler needs to assume any int could be the same thing. So it is a bit easier, but they still have some of these problems. So any other questions about addressing things? Okay, so we're gonna look at some other limitations in our last 5 minutes, and we'll finish this up next time. So I mentioned that we have these limitations that the compilers don't look inside methods and don't have these code versus speed size trade-offs. So I'll give one example here of, here's a simple function where we have this utility function to sum with a maximum size. Seems nice and simple. You know, and we're gonna just call this in a loop rather than using add. You know, this is the most straightforward way to write this sort of thing. And note that it's slightly different than just breaking out a loop when we hit it 10,000 because we might have negative numbers. So the most straightforward thing to do is to, for the compiler, is to generate the sum with limit function and call it. And so we're gonna have a function call for sum with limit. And this takes up three instructions that don't do anything related to actually computing any sum or doing any comparison to 10,000. And an additional ret instruction that also doesn't do any work that's useful. So this means that if the compiler generates this function call, we're wasting four instructions worth of work, which is going to be slower. And even on an out-of-order processor, that's gonna still not gonna be parallelized with everything else, most likely. So this will often end up being slower. And because the compiler usually can't look between methods, especially if they're in different files, The compiler sometimes won't do this for you. So this means if you write code like this, it will be faster. Sometimes. Because we don't have this extra moves to set up the function call. We don't have the extra work to call and return, you know, which is also accesses to memory to write the return address and read it. So this can save a lot of time for a simple function like this, which is basically two or three instructions. So this is called function inlining. We're putting the function in line where it belongs. So this saves those extra instructions. It also helps the compiler out in some other ways. So one thing, for example, is that if you inline a function, the compiler knows more, for example, about whether things alias. Also, if you inline a function, the compiler can use more registers. So it doesn't need to worry about call or save registers anymore. Whereas with the other function call, maybe it would spill things to the stack because it had wanted to use all the registers and it ran out. So inlining seems great. Why don't we always do it? And that there's several big reasons. So one is that the compiler doesn't look at the other file that contains the method implementation when it compiles it. Another is that it can make your performance worse. So if you inlined all the time, you make your programs much bigger, and this would be worse for the instruction cache. And if your program got big enough, then you'd be spending all your time fetching instructions from memory, from slow memory rather than the instruction cache, and it would be slower. So the compiler can't just inline everything. So even though it can do this for you, it's not going to inline everything, because if it does that, that's going to tend to make your program slower. So you sometimes will want to do this yourself, to help out the compiler when you know this function is important and should not use a function call. It's called often enough, and it's small enough or important enough that I want to just put it directly inside to get rid of that extra overhead. So it's not that compilers don't do inlining. It's just that they avoid making your code much bigger. So usually, what the compiler will do is that if two functions are in the same file, they'll inline one and the other if the inline function is very small. But if it's bigger than a certain size, it won't bother. It will assume that it's not important enough, the overhead, versus the extra size, and so it won't do it. It also might inline if the function is called exactly once, because then you only need one copy. And it will not inline across .o files, because would be inlining done in the linker. This is actually a thing which does happen with some optimizing compilers, can do that sort of thing, but it's not a default. And it is much, much slower to compile. So inlining is something you can do yourself when the compiler is not going to figure it out because one of these heuristics doesn't happen, or because it's across .o files. I note that some compilers have hints where you can say on a function, please try to inline this, or please do not inline this. And you're allowed to use them if you figure them out, but the general strategy is to just put the code from one function into the other. So that's all I have for today. I guess any questions about inlining before I finish up? Okay. So next time I'll talk about loop optimizations and some other miscellaneous issues.